Rebus leadership group to place himself and his family under their control. The Taliban were entering a new phase of power and ambition just as bin Laden arrived. They were no longer the humble, consultative Pashtun country folk of late 1994 and early 1995. They had evolved into a political-military movement with national goals. Some of their leaders, such as Prince Turki's favorite, Mullah Rabbani, continued to hint to foreign visitors and United Nations diplomats that the Taliban were just a transition force. He and other moderate Taliban leaders, as they were now being called by American diplomats, said the Taliban would cleanse Afghanistan of its criminal warlords and create a fresh political start, perhaps including a return of the exiled king. But increasingly, such claims had to be reconciled with menacing scenes of the Taliban's appetite for power. Its leaders openly denounced the Massoud-defended government in Kabul as the root cause of all evils in Afghanistan. Omar summoned more than 1,000 Pashtun religious scholars and tribal leaders to Kandahar for a 2-week grand assembly in the early weeks of spring 1996. It was the most overt political meeting of Pashtuns under Taliban leadership since the movement's birth. Omar chose his ground and his symbols carefully. At the meeting's climax, he called the delegates to the great stone and tile square across from the Kandahar governor's house. Within the square's gates stood the tomb of the 18th century king, Ahmed Shah Durrani, and the tile-inlaid mosque of the cloak of the Holy Prophet. Omar climbed to the mosque's roof and unveiled the holy cloak. As the crowd roared approval, he wrapped himself dramatically in the relic. The assembled delegates formally ratified him as Amir ul Mu'minin, Commander of the Faithful. They created and sanctified a new name for the expanding territory under Taliban control, the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. They called for jihad against Massoud. Some denounced Zahir Shah as a criminal. Surrounded by the symbolic remnants of a lost Durrani empire, they had proclaimed their own one-eyed king. Virtually by herself in the Clinton administration, Robin Rafel tried to drum up a climate of urgency about all-party Afghan peace talks, then being sponsored by the United Nations. Rafel had support from a few members of Congress, but hardly any backing from the White House. The State Department's South Asia Bureau, which Rafel ran, saw the Taliban as a distasteful but well-established faction on the Afghan checkerboard. The United States now endorsed Pakistan's view that peace talks must include the movement's leaders. By its secret support for the Taliban and its continual public lies, Pakistan had made the Taliban a fact of international diplomacy. And the Americans accepted their legitimacy. At the same time, Rafel's public statements made clear that state opposed all efforts to solve the Afghan war by military victory, whether by the Taliban or Massoud. Rafel traveled to Kabul, Kandahar, and Islamabad on April 19 and 20, 1996. "Tell President Clinton and the West that we are not bad people," a Taliban leader told her in the Pashtun capital. Rafel and U.S. Ambassador Tom Simons concluded that the Taliban's humble, simplistic messages might reflect a growing awareness, previously absent, of their own limitations, as Simons wrote in a cable to Washington. Rafel and the ambassador believed, wrongly, that a consensus has emerged in the Pakistan government's civilian and military leadership about the need to broaden their policies toward Afghanistan. As she had done before, Bhutto lied to Rafel in meetings and emphasized that Pakistan was not providing military support to the Taliban and insisted that only minimal, non-lethal aid was being delivered. Rafel absorbed Pakistan's hostility toward Massoud and carried it into her meetings with the commander in Kabul. Massoud outlined a vision for a bottom-up democracy in Afghanistan, but Rafel and Simons dismissed this rosy scenario in a confidential cable to Washington and denounced the self-righteousness of Massoud's besieged government. For their part, Massoud and his aides were put off by what they saw as Rafel's lecturing. Rafel seemed to treat Afghanistan as a wilderness threatening the stability of Pakistan, as one of Massoud's intelligence officers put it. Massoud and his intelligence advisors worried that the CIA had covertly joined with ISI to engineer a Taliban takeover of Kabul to create favorable conditions for the Unocal pipeline. Massoud's government had signed an agreement with Unocal's Argentine rival, banking a $1 million payment in a New York account belonging to one of Massoud's advisors. They feared they had been branded as Unocal's, and therefore America's, enemy. In truth, nobody in Washington cared enough to conspire about Afghan politics. Still, Rafel and her State Department colleagues heard accusations about a CIA-led, Unocal-driven plot in Afghanistan over and over that spring. A decade of covert action in the 1980s had conditioned many Afghans and Pakistanis to see the CIA as a powerful force in their affairs. Rafel and her colleagues heard the CIA-Unocal-Taliban conspiracy stories so often and in such credible detail that they privately asked Langley a few times for confirmation that there was no fire beneath all this smoke. They were assured that the CIA was clean. More than any other American official at the time, Rafel outlined publicly the dangers an unstable Afghanistan posed to the world. The country has become a conduit for drugs, crime, and terrorism that can undermine Pakistan and the neighboring Central Asian states and have an impact beyond Europe and Russia, she predicted. She warned that terrorist incidents in the Middle East had been traced back to Afghan training camps. She argued that the Taliban's severe interpretations of Islam defied Afghan traditions, and that ultimately the balance of power would shift toward a more tolerant theology. Yet her policy prescriptions were all vague or narrowly drawn around commercial interests. The United States was concerned that economic opportunities here will be missed, Rafel said publicly during her visit to Kabul that spring. She told a Russian counterpart in a private meeting, "The United States government now hopes that peace in the region will facilitate U.S. business interests." In Islamabad, she declared that Unocal's pipeline will be very good for Turkmenistan, for Pakistan, and for Afghanistan, as it will not only offer job opportunities, but also energy in Afghanistan. It was a tawdry season in American diplomacy. After years of withdrawal and disengagement, American policy had been captured by the language of corporate deal-making. In the absence of alternatives, the State Department had taken up Unocal's agenda as its own. Whatever the merits of the project, the sheer prominence it received by 1996 distorted the message and meaning of American power. American tolerance of the Taliban was publicly and inextricably linked to the financial goals of an oil corporation. There were now about 1.5 million Afghan war dead, dating back to the Soviet invasion. The land was desolate, laced with mines. The average life expectancy for an Afghan was about 46 years. The country ranked 173rd out of 175 countries on the United Nations Human Development Index. Yet the few American officials who paid attention to Afghanistan at all talked as if it was a tax-free zone ripe for industrial revival, a place where vocational education and metallurgy could lead to a political breakthrough. For Afghans themselves, the central question in the spring of bin Laden's return was the military potential of the Taliban. For more than a decade, the key to internal power in Afghanistan had been access to outside military supplies and cash, especially from Pakistan. Here, too, the ground was now shifting. In Islamabad, in the secret councils of her National Security Cabinet, Benazir Bhutto had entered into a new phase of debate with Pakistani intelligence about the Taliban. By the spring of 1996, she had capitulated, she said later, to ISI's persistent requests for unlimited covert aid to the Islamic militia. But as the Taliban gathered strength and territory, Bhutto and her civilian allies clung to the hope that they could use the Taliban to force a negotiated, all-party political deal under the auspices of the United Nations. As Bhutto recalled it, ISI Director General Nasim Rana and several of his key brigadiers asked her for permission to arm, equip, and train the Taliban for a final drive on Kabul. If the Taliban took control of the Afghan capital, ISI's officers argued, Pakistan would have at last achieved General Zia's dream, a loyal Pashtun-led Islamist government in Kabul. Bhutto resisted. She feared that a Taliban government would press its Islamic militancy on toward Central Asia, damaging the trade-driven relationships she sought to build there. It would be much more profitable to use the Taliban's clout to negotiate for a peace deal in Afghanistan that would include Massoud and other northern ethnic militias that had strong ties to Central Asia. Bhutto turned for support to her secular-minded Chief of Army Staff, General Jehangir Karamat, Pakistan's supreme military commander. "When the pressure would get too much," she recalled, "I would have a meeting with the Army Chief and with my defense cabinet and all of the military brass, the Air Force Chief and the Navy Chief, and they would support my idea that, no, you must work with the UN. But Pakistani intelligence was more and more insistent, she recalled. It seemed evident that they intended to push the Taliban into Kabul without telling Bhutto. Whether ISI also evaded orders from Karamat or privately received a supportive nod from the Army High Command was never clear to Bhutto. All the while, the Prime Minister and her aides continued to lie to American officials about the nature and extent of Pakistan's covert support to the Taliban. The American ambassador to Pakistan, Tom Simons, talked repeatedly with Karamat and other senior generals as the Taliban approached Kabul's gates in the late spring and early summer of 1996. It seemed to Simons that the Pakistani army felt trapped by the momentum of its own policies in Afghanistan. The Punjabi secularists in their senior ranks viewed the Taliban cynically and worried that they had cooked up a recipe for endless war and that Pakistan was going to be drained and it was going to weaken Pakistan. Yet the generals told Simons they also felt that there was no alternative, no realistic alternative for the country. Kabul's fall came swiftly. Osama bin Laden, now Afghanistan's wealthiest sheikh, hurried it along. Taliban forces launched a surprise attack against the Jalalabad Shura in August. Haji Qadir and the rest of bin Laden's original greeting party fled across the border to Pakistan. The Taliban took control of the area, and bin Laden was now in their midst. The Saudi may have provided about $3 million from his personal treasury to pay off the remaining commanders who stood between the Taliban and Kabul, although bin Laden was under some financial pressure at the time. The Taliban may also have collected funds for these crucial bribes from other Saudi and Gulf patrons, the local trucking mafia, heroin traders, Pakistani intelligence, and other sources. Bin Laden spent his first summer back in Afghanistan writing a lengthy fatwa about the alliance of enemies that had delivered him to this exile. His Declaration of Jihad on the Americans occupying the two sacred places laid out his belief that the Saudi royal family had become the agent of an alliance between imperialist Jews and Christians. He protested that he had been pursued in Pakistan, Sudan, and Afghanistan. He referred to his new haven as Khorasan, in reference to a lost Islamic empire that had once encompassed Central Asia. He faxed his proclamation to London newspapers as the Taliban turned their speedy pickup trucks toward Kabul. Massoud lost the Afghan capital after forging one last ill-advised alliance with his old enemy, Gurbuddin Hekmatyar. Fearing correctly that ISI had abandoned him for the Taliban, Hekmatyar reached out to Massoud for help. Massoud had little choice. Hekmatyar's militia, however untrustworthy, extended his defensive perimeter east and south and held the Taliban farther out from Kabul. But Hekmatyar kept asking Massoud to bring his troops out from the capital to attack the Taliban. Every day Hekmatyar was worried, saying, "They're working to a plan. They've taken Paktia, and you've done nothing. You're not cooperating. You're not fighting," Massoud said later. President Rabbani told Massoud, "Well, maybe Hekmatyar's right." But Massoud was now leading his troops into eastern and southern territory that he had never held during the long anti-Soviet war. He was not familiar with the terrain. He and his aides moved to meet the Taliban while studying their maps. "We came out," Massoud said, "but we didn't pay attention to the defensive line." The trap sprang shut on September 25 at Sarobi, Kabul's eastern gateway. Hekmatyar's local commanders sold out to the Taliban and stood aside. The Taliban had perfected mobile fighting with a cavalry of Japanese pickup trucks armed with powerful machine guns in their beds. They darted and swooped up the gorges from Sarabi and across Kabul's open southern plains. Massoud's helicopter and fighter-bomber strikes could not ward off these potent swarms. On September 26, Massoud told a council of generals that they had to withdraw. Overnight, they rolled as many tanks and armored vehicles as they could organize north from the capital toward the Panjshir Valley, Massoud's fortified rock gorge homeland. The Taliban poured into Kabul the next day. They wore black turbans and smeared their eyes with decorative coal. They walked unopposed into pockmarked ministry buildings and unfurled their blankets on the floors. Within a day, every major government building, palace, and military base in the city had been occupied by bands of Pashtun fighters. After Kabul fell to the Mujahideen in April 1992, the former Afghan president Najibullah lived under house arrest at a United Nations compound in the city. Rabbani and Massoud never brought the former communist and secret police chief to trial, nor were they willing to release him into exile. Najibullah spent his years of incarceration watching satellite television, lifting free weights, and translating a history of British-era Afghanistan called The Great Game from English into Pashto. "Afghans keep making the same mistake," he told one visitor, reflecting on his translation. The Taliban burst into Najibullah's house on September 27 while his brother was visiting. Judging by the conditions of their bodies when they were strung up above a traffic circle hours later, the brothers died slowly and painfully under blows from fists, stones, and sticks. The former president of Afghanistan, whose career began in the torture chambers of the secret police and ended at roundtables with international diplomats, probably expired before the wire tied around his neck pulled him up the 10-foot gallows pole selected by the Taliban for its visible location in central Kabul. "We killed him because he was the murderer of our people," Mullah Omar declared. The capital's new laws were announced as edicts on Kabul radio, quickly renamed the Voice of the Sharia, or Islamic Law. Toothpaste should be abandoned in favor of the natural route favored by the Prophet, the radio announcers declared. Their lists of banned items and activities unfurled as a roll call of life's small pleasures. Marbles, cigarettes, dancing, music, singing, homing pigeons, kite flying, television watching. Businessmen and traders were warned that they should no longer wrap their goods in paper in case they inadvertently used pages from the Holy Quran. The Saudi-inspired Ministry for the Propagation of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice announced a ban on both sorcery and American-style haircuts. Taliban leaders ordered women to disappear. "All of those sisters who are working in government offices are hereby informed to stay at home until further notice," the radio announced on the first day. "Also, since satar, Islamic dress, is of great importance in Islam, all sisters are seriously asked to cover their faces and the whole of their body when going out." 8,000 female undergraduate students at Kabul University lost their places at the school. A similar number of school teachers lost their jobs. Thousands of women who worked as civil servants in bloated government ministries, contributing meager but steady salaries to their extended families, were banned from their offices. 6 weeks later, the Taliban announced a numbered list of regulations that would be enforced by their religious police. Number one said that to prevent sedition and uncovered females, taxi drivers could not stop for any woman who did not wear a full Iranian-style burqa. Number 12 announced that all women found washing clothes in any river would be picked up by the religious police in a respectful and Islamic manner and returned to their homes, where their husbands would be severely punished. Number 15 listed jail terms for tailors who took female body measurements or displayed fashion magazines. The State Department greeted these announcements with little protest. Its diplomats hoped to appease Kabul's new rulers. "We wish to engage the new Taliban interim government at an early stage," declared a classified instructions cable sent from Washington to embassies abroad on September 28. In official meetings with the Taliban, American diplomats should strive to demonstrate American willingness to deal with them as the new authorities in Kabul, seek information about their plans, programs, and policies, and express U.S. government views on areas of key concern to us, stability, human rights, narcotics, and terrorism. Bin Laden ranked last on the cable's more detailed list of issues for discussion. Washington's confidential talking points suggested two very gentle questions for Taliban leaders. One was, "We welcomed your assurances that you were closing the terrorist and militant training camps formerly run by Hekmatyar, Sayaf, or Arab groups. Can you tell us the current status of those camps?" The second, "Do you know the location of ex-Saudi financier and radical Islamist Osama bin Laden? We heard previously that he was in the eastern provinces. His continued presence here would not, we believe, serve Afghanistan's interests." Taliban leaders telephoned American diplomats in Islamabad and said they had no idea where bin Laden was. Ambassador Tom Simons met at the shaded Islamabad embassy compound on November 8 with Mullah Ghaus, the Taliban's acting foreign minister, who, like Omar, had only one eye. "I wish to say some things about America," Simons announced, according to notes taken by an American diplomat at the meeting. "The Americans are the most religious people in the Western world. They have great respect for Islam, which is now the fastest-growing religious community in America. There are, in fact, now more American Muslims than American Jews," he added, as if this might assuage Taliban attitudes toward the United States. "Yet Americans," Simons continued, "have learned that it is very difficult to discern the will of God. Their experience has taught them that it is dangerous for one group to try to impose its interpretation of the will of God on others, and especially dangerous to try to do so by force." Gauss listened politely. He said the Taliban hoped for peace, but they would never yield to their enemies, especially not to Massoud and his allies to the north. On December 6, Simon's deputy relayed a letter to the Taliban from Secretary of State Warren Christopher offering engagement, but adding, "We wish to work with you to expel all terrorists and those who support terrorism from Afghanistan." Robin Rafel handed the original to the man the Taliban hoped would agree to represent them at the United Nations, Hamid Karzai. Rafel outlined American policy to a closed meeting of the UN Security Council in New York. "For the sake of peace," she argued, "all nations should engage with the Taliban. The Taliban control more than two-thirds of the country. They are Afghan, they are indigenous, they have demonstrated their staying power," Rafel said. "The real source of their success has been the willingness of many Afghans, particularly Pashtuns, to tacitly trade unending fighting and chaos for a measure of peace and security, even with severe social restrictions." The Taliban were now a fact of international life, Rafel argued. "It is not in the interests of Afghanistan or any of us here that the Taliban be isolated." 19. We're keeping these stingers. Islamabad Station Chief Gary Schroens' secret flight into Kabul in September 1996 and his midnight discussion with Ahmed Shah Massoud about stingers and bin Laden marked the rebirth of unilateral CIA engagements in Afghanistan after a four-year hiatus. The agency managed three secret programs that provided resources for Schroen and his Islamabad case officers. The National Security Council's decision early in 1996 to fund and approve the Counterterrorist Center's new virtual station to track Osama bin Laden meant there were now funds, analysts, and case officers dedicated to collecting intelligence on the Saudi and his operations. A walk-in defector from Al-Qaeda, Jamal al-Fadl, revealed to the bin Laden unit late in 1996 that they had been underestimating their target. Bin Laden, the CIA now learned, had planned multiple terrorist operations and aspired to more. The virtual station needed help from Islamabad. Schroen's group maintained the agency's liaison with ISI, which had multiple connections to bin Laden's world. Schroen had also opened a dialogue with Massoud. cables flowed steadily between the bin Laden station in Virginia and the Islamabad station even after Massoud retreated from Kabul. In addition, from inside Langley headquarters, the counter-terrorist center maintained a full branch dedicated to finding Mir Amal Kazi, the fugitive Baluchi who had attacked CIA headquarters in 1993. The Kazi branch authorized funds for the Islamabad station to recruit paid unilateral agents, some of them Afghans, to look for Kazi. Most richly funded of all was the program Langley operated that had been the main impetus for Schroen's clandestine September visit to Massoud in Kabul, Stinger missile recovery. By the time the Taliban took Kabul, an estimated 600 of the approximately 2,300 Stinger missiles distributed by the CIA during the anti-Soviet war remained missing. There was an active market for the missiles across Central Asia and the Middle East. The Iranians were buying as many as they could. CIA officers estimated very roughly that Tehran had acquired about 100 Stingers. Most of the remaining inventory was believed to be in Afghanistan. Some Afghan warlords correctly saw possession of a batch of Stingers as a better financial investment than many of the local paper currencies. Through its intermediaries, the CIA offered to buy not just the warheads for hard cash, but also the tubes from which they were fired. A secondary market grew up in Afghanistan for empty tubes. Con artists tried to imitate the missile's design and sell fakes to middlemen. Prices for complete missiles soared from $70,000 to $150,000 as sellers hoarded their wares. The agency turned to allies across the Middle East for help. Prince Turki's chief of staff, Ahmed Badib, flew as far as Somalia to pick up Stingers that had been smuggled into Africa. But much of the program was run out of the Islamabad station, where the Stingers had first been distributed. Until 1996, the CIA maintained a B-200 Cessna twin-engine turboprop airplane in Islamabad dedicated to Stinger recovery. CIA pilots flew it around the region to pick up missiles. They were then stored in Islamabad until a larger transport plane could ferry them to the United States, where they were turned over to the U.S. Army for destruction. Occasionally, if CIA officers bought missiles in some place where transport was impossible, they would dig a pit and blow them up with plastic explosives, taking photographs to document their destruction. After the Taliban took Kabul, the CIA decided to make a direct offer to the militia's leaders to buy back Stingers from them. The agency had been informed that Mullah Omar possessed 53 Stinger missiles that had been collected from various Pashtun warlords loyal to the Taliban. Early in 1997, Gary Schroen sought permission from headquarters to fly into Kandahar and make a cash buyback offer to senior Taliban mullahs. Langley agreed. With help from diplomats in the Islamabad embassy, Schroen contacted the Taliban Shura in Kandahar. They sent back word that they would welcome an American delegation. At going rates, a CIA repurchase of all the Taliban's Stingers would provide the militia's force with an instant cash infusion of between $5 million and $8 million, about double the amount later reported to have been provided to the Taliban by bin Laden to aid the conquest of Kabul. At the time of Schroen's request to travel to Kandahar, the United States had little evidence that bin Laden had connected with the Taliban. While not a large amount by U.S. aid program standards, such a payment would still be a sizable infusion of unrestricted cash for a militia whose leaders daily announced new codes of medieval conduct. Yet a presidentially authorized covert action policy at the time encouraged the CIA to buy Stingers wherever they could be found. It was unclear during the fall of 1996 whether the United States regarded the Taliban as friend or foe. In the weeks after the fall of Kabul, mid-level American officials issued a cacophony of statements, some skeptical, some apparently supportive, from which it was impossible to deduce a clear position. American diplomats in Islamabad told reporters that the Taliban could play a useful role in restoring a strong central government to Afghanistan. The Taliban themselves worried about rumors that they received support from the CIA and were a pro-American force, refused to receive a low-level State Department visitor to Kabul. The U.S. does not support the Taliban, has not supported the Taliban, and will not support the Taliban, the spurned envoy, Lee Coldren, announced in reply. Within days, then-U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Madeleine Albright denounced the Taliban decrees in Kabul as impossible to justify or defend. But just 3 weeks after that, Robin Rafel outlined the Taliban's claims to legitimacy before the U.N. Security Council and pleaded that they not be isolated. It was difficult to tell which of these State Department officials spoke for themselves and which spoke for the United States. Rafel's call for engagement with the Taliban attracted support outside the Clinton administration, especially from UNICAL. Marty Miller and his colleagues hoped the Taliban takeover of Kabul would speed their pipeline negotiations. Within weeks of the capital's capture, UNICAL formed a new financial partnership to build the pipeline, announced the creation of an advisory board made up of prestigious American experts on South and Central Asia, and opened a new office in the Taliban heartland, Kandahar. Marty Miller insisted publicly that UNICAL remained fanatically neutral about Afghan politics, but it was clear that the Taliban's military victory would be helpful in reducing the number of parties to the UNICAL pipeline talks. Republican and congressional experts also declared that America should give the Taliban a chance. "It is time for the United States to re-engage," wrote Zalmay Khalizad, one of the American government's leading Afghan specialists, soon after the Taliban takeover of Kabul. "The Taliban does not practice the anti-U.S. style of fundamentalism practiced by Iran. It is closer to the Saudi model." This remained a common prism of American thinking about Islamist political movements. Saudi Arabia was conservative, pious, and non-threatening, while Iran was active, violent, and revolutionary. As doctrinaire Sunni Muslims, the Taliban vehemently opposed Iran and its Shiite creed, and in that sense, they were allied with American interests. Khalilzad was soon invited to join UNICAL's advisory board, along with Robert Oakley, the former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan. In this atmosphere of drift and desultory debate about the Taliban's meaning, Gary Schroen and a team of embassy diplomats flew into Kandahar in February 1997 on a scheduled United Nations charter. They circled down to a vast mud-baked plain laced by eroded riverbeds. The American team rolled from the airport through a dry, flat, treeless expanse where sagebrush hopped and tumbled in the desert wind. Shadowed rock hills rose to the west. On the buckled highway to town, they passed state-owned farming cooperatives, green orchards, and walled farming villages. Amid smoky bustle, horse carts, and scooters, they entered Kandahar City through a painted arch called Chicken Post, protected by armed Taliban guards. Pedestrians crowded into the roadway, almost all of them tall, bearded Pashtun men in colorful turbans and loose, cool cotton robes. The city itself was a flat expanse of market stalls and mud-walled compounds. Mullah Omar's modest house lay behind a wall on the Herat Bazaar Road in the center of town, near Kandahar's university, which the Taliban had converted into a religious madrasa. In the city's central square, the militia occasionally staged mock executions of radios and televisions, bashing them to pieces and hanging them by their cords. Schroen and his colleagues bunked overnight in a United Nations guest house, a small enclave of foreigners, fluorescent lights, and canned Coca-Cola. They contacted the Taliban foreign ministry to arrange their appointment. Omar declined to see them since they were not Muslims, but they were granted an audience with the local governor and Omar's chief aide, Mullah Waqil Ahmed. They drove the next day to the governor's house, a striking, crumbling, arched sandstone building set in a garden of spruce trees and rose bushes. The Taliban did not give the impression that they cared much for its carved ceilings or Persian-influenced mosaics. They laced the building with mines and bombs, and kept their stingers in a locked storage area off the inner courtyard. Schroen joined a meeting that was to include diplomatic discussions about refugee and aid issues. Several local leaders sat on the Taliban side. None of the Taliban wore shoes or sandals. They picked continually at their feet, the Americans could not help but notice. The Taliban governor of Kandahar was Mohammed Hassan, a former Quetta madrasa student who had fought against the Soviets in Uruzgan province. He had lost a fingertip and a leg in battle during the anti-Soviet jihad. He had been fitted with an artificial limb that had a spring and release mechanism. During the meeting, he fooled with his leg, and it snapped out of position occasionally with a loud crack. Then Hassan would grab it and slowly push it back into its locked set. Afterward, Shroan met privately with Hassan and Wakil. He outlined through a translator how the CIA's Stinger recovery program worked. The United States would be grateful if the Taliban would sell back the Stingers they had, and the Taliban would be well paid if they agreed. Shroan mentioned that one goal was to keep the missiles out of Iran's hands. Hassan and Wakil said that they had no desire to sell their missiles. They were going to need them in the future. "We are keeping these Stingers because we're going to use them on the Iranians," they explained. Their first task was to finish off Ahmed Shah Massoud and his coalition in northern Afghanistan. After that, they fully expected to end up in a war with Iran, they said. They needed the missiles to shoot down helicopters and jets from the Iranian Air Force. Surely, they said, the Americans could appreciate the Iranian threat. Shroan flew back to Islamabad, empty-handed. Osama bin Laden began to move his operations south, toward Kandahar, the center of Taliban power. In November 1996, the Palestinian newspaper editor, Abdul Bari Atwan, met him in a cave outside of Kandahar. Bin Laden had a personal computer in his bunker and a library of bound volumes. He told Atwan that he felt back home, because the whole Islamic world is a homeland for Muslims. He made it clear that he regarded the United States as his enemy. Recent terrorist bombings against American targets in Saudi Arabia, at Riyadh and Iran, were a laudable kind of terrorism, because it was against thieves. He boasted of his endurance. "Having borne arms against the Russians for 10 years, we think our battle with the Americans will be easy by comparison, and we are now more determined to carry on until we see the face of God." That winter, bin Laden worked to build his global reputation through the international media. He seemed determined to convince his audience in the Arab world that exile in Afghanistan had not marginalized him. To Palestinians, he denounced American support for Israel, although he placed less emphasis on this issue than many other Arabs did. To his Saudi countrymen, he repeated his attacks on the royal family for corruption, weak enforcement of Islamic laws, and most of all, for allowing American troops on Saudi soil. For the first time, he also began to reach out aggressively to American and English-language media to deliver warnings and sermons. Sometimes he shaped his message to his audience. Other times, he uncorked long theological speeches without apparent concern for his listeners. He spoke of Islam's wrath and his determination to evict Christian crusader military forces from Muslim lands, especially Saudi Arabia. "The concentration at this point of jihad is against the American occupiers," he told a CNN interviewer. As he raised his media profile, bin Laden also insinuated himself into Mullah Omar's realm. He arrived in the desert warmth of Kandahar that winter with praise for Omar's wisdom and grand ideas about construction projects that could transform the Pashtun spiritual capital, filling it with enduring symbols of Taliban faith and power. Pakistani intelligence may have facilitated bin Laden's introductions to the Taliban. To train militants for Kashmir, ISI used and subsidized guerrilla training camps that were now falling under bin Laden's sway. According to one former CIA case officer, ISI wired bin Laden's new house in Kandahar for security. Pakistani intelligence also allowed cross-border travel by journalists summoned by the Saudi. For both the Taliban and ISI, bin Laden was in one sense an uncomfortable new ally and benefactor. His repeated denunciations of Saudi Arabia's royal family angered a wealthy and powerful patron of Pakistani intelligence and its Afghan clients. But Saudi intelligence chief Prince Turki Al-Faisal made it clear to the Taliban after they took Kabul that he would not confront them over their hospitality to bin Laden. After the fall of the Afghan capital, Prince Turki recalled, the Taliban sent a message to the kingdom. "We have this fellow here. Do you want us to hand him to you, or shall we keep him here? We offered him refuge." The Saudis had just turned away from a possible chance to take custody of bin Laden from Sudan the previous spring. The royal family still apparently believed it was better to have bin Laden at large in Afghanistan than at home in detention or in jail, where he might become a magnet for anti-royal dissent. The Saudis had ample evidence to charge bin Laden with serious crimes. They had already executed four of his followers for carrying out the Riyadh bombing of an American facility in November 1995, but they were still not prepared to endure the political risks of bin Laden's trial or martyrdom. Prince Turki recalled that his government told the Taliban in reply, "Well, if you have already offered him refuge, make sure that he does not operate against the kingdom or say anything against the kingdom." Turki felt that the Taliban had agreed to take charge of keeping his mouth shut. Bin Laden had his own plan. He would convert the Taliban to his cause. Unocal rented a house in central Kandahar directly across the street from one of bin Laden's new compounds. They did not choose this location deliberately. Most of the decent houses in town straddled the Herat Bazaar Road. Also nearby was the Pakistani consulate, which housed officers from ISI. Charlie Santos, a former United Nations diplomat in Afghanistan, had been hired by Unocal's small Saudi partner, Delta, to provide analysis and consulting services on Afghan affairs as the American oil company tried to negotiate its contract. Unocal visitors and consultants had an up-close view of bin Laden's rising impact on the city during the early months of 1997. The Saudi sheikh swept through Kandahar in convoys of pickup trucks and luxury Toyota sport utility vehicles with tinted windows. Moving with a formidable bodyguard of Arabs and Afghans, he came and went from downtown unannounced, a spectral presence in flowing white robes. As his convoy passed, Pashtun men in the fume-choked bazaars would point and whisper discreetly, "Osama, Osama." On some Fridays, he delivered sermons at Kandahar's largest mosque. Afghans reported to Santos that Mullah Omar called bin Laden out of the audience at one sermon and praised him before the crowd as one of Islam's most important spiritual leaders. With the public rituals of mutual flattery came word of expensive construction projects designed to provide Kandahar with a new face. Ground was broken near the governor's house on an elaborate new mosque to be financed by bin Laden and his supporters. There was also planning for a grand new Eid mosque to celebrate breaking the fast at the end of Ramadan, to be constructed on the southern outskirts of Kandahar. It would be a true people's mosque, used only once each year. Wealthy Arabs from Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the Persian Gulf flew into Kandahar for bustard hunting in the nearby deserts. The Arabs arrived on chartered jets and brought mind-boggling luxuries for their weeks-long hunts. Bin Laden sometimes participated. These were potential donors to his operations. In addition to his urban Kandahar compound, bin Laden installed his family and dozens of his Arab followers on the flat desert plains a dozen miles outside of town, near the Kandahar airport. During the early Cold War period, when American contractors built the airport, they also constructed apartment buildings so that their expatriate workforce would have decent quarters. The apartments were some four decades old now, but they still compared favorably to local accommodations. The Taliban allowed bin Laden's Arab entourage to move in. They also gave him the keys to Turnak Farm, a walled government-run agricultural cooperative complex on the outskirts of the airport. The farm had several dozen buildings and was isolated and secure in a stretch of empty desert. At least one of bin Laden's wives and a number of his children moved in during the first months of 1997. Local Afghans also reported to Santos and the United Nations that bin Laden had announced plans to construct a training complex for Arab Mujahideen in Uruzgan province, where Mullah Omar had roots. Bin Laden planned to train foreign volunteers who would aid the Taliban in their continuing military campaign against Massoud. The United States still had no legal indictment or covert action plan to target bin Laden. The virtual bin Laden station in Virginia tracked his financial dealings and analyzed his public statements, but had yet to direct lethal operations against him. The CIA met with Unocal executives to debrief them on Central Asian pipeline politics, but they never asked for help in watching, capturing, or attacking bin Laden in Kandahar that winter. The U.S. Embassy in Islamabad informed Senator Hank Brown late in 1996 that bin Laden had appeared at a meeting in Afghanistan and announced a $1 million reward for Brown's assassination. Brown was told that he should not travel to the region anymore. Yet this threat still did not galvanize a plan to attack bin Laden, whose paramilitary and terrorist ambitions remained something of a mystery to both the CIA and the White House Counterterrorism Office. In fact, bin Laden had already dispatched operatives to Africa and elsewhere to prepare for terrorist strikes against American targets. But the United States was unaware of these plans. The White House did not begin to push for covert operations against bin Laden beyond intelligence collection until the end of 1997, a year after he established himself openly in Mullah Omar's Kandahar. American and Saudi officials met regularly and cordially with Taliban representatives during these months. UNICAL sponsored visits for Taliban leaders to the United States so they could see the company's oil operations, and its lobbyists helped to arrange meetings at the State Department. These contacts encouraged the belief in Washington that there were Taliban moderates, sincere young Pashtuns in the leadership shuras interested in international dialogue who would lead their movement toward political responsibility. Mullah Gauss was often credited with such potential, as was Mullah Rabbani, Saudi Arabia's protege. Rabbani traveled that spring to Riyadh and declared after a meeting with the ailing King Fahd, "Since Saudi Arabia is the center of the Muslim world, we would like to have Saudi assistance." King Fahd expressed happiness at the good measures taken by the Taliban and over the imposition of Sharia in our country. The Taliban also retained support during these months from important Durrani Pashtuns, such as members of the Karzai family. The triumph of Taliban power in Kabul meant trade and economic opportunity for Durrani Pashtuns across the south. Relative to the recent past, Kandahar was now an Arab-funded boomtown. Mullah Omar, who continued to demonstrate that he meant what he said, openly outlined his future plans. "War is a tricky game," he told a Pakistani visitor in March 1997. "We feel a military solution has better prospects now, after numerous failed attempts to reach a peaceful, negotiated settlement." A few weeks later, a Taliban spokesman formally acknowledged that Osama bin Laden had moved to Kandahar. Now bin Laden could go and see the leader directly. "The world had nothing to fear," he said. "We will not allow Afghanistan to be used to launch terrorist attack." Ahmed Shah Massoud and his tattered army retreated from Kabul to a cold Panjshir winter. They had known this sort of hardship before, and worse, during the anti-Soviet campaigns of the 1980s. But to lose control of the capital was a deep blow. Massoud blamed his longtime political mentor, President Burhanuddin Rabbani, for failing to make coalition politics in Kabul work while Massoud concentrated on security and war. Massoud felt cheated because he had never been able to focus full-time on politics, recalled his aide Harun Amin. After Kabul's loss, he thought that Rabbani and the other political leaders were incompetent, couldn't be trusted. Massoud's men recovered steadily because they knew they faced a long war with an extremist Pashtun militia in which surrender would lead to annihilation. Massoud held open the possibility of a negotiated compromise with the Taliban, but his main emphasis that winter was on recovering the battlefield. "He never thought for a second that he would lose Afghanistan," recalled his brother Ahmed Wali. Within weeks, he had assembled a meeting of defeated northern ethnic militias and announced a new alliance, initially called the Supreme Council for the Defense of the Motherland, and later recast as the United Front. Massoud had grown isolated during his last years in Kabul. More than ever, he and his closest aides knew they needed international support. Russia, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan were all threatened by the Taliban's announced plans to liberate Central Asian Muslims. Massoud dispatched some of his longest-serving intelligence and foreign policy aides abroad to open talks with potential backers. Massoud offered himself as a bulwark against Islamic radicalism. He opened negotiations with Russia about arms supplies and airfield access, as Moscow dispatched 28,000 soldiers to Central Asia, partly to defend against Taliban-sponsored incursions. Iran weighed in with offers of money, weapons, and humanitarian aid. India, ever ready to support an enemy of Pakistan or its proxies, would become another source of funding. Massoud had to scratch together money and arms. There was cash available in his Panjshir redoubts from gem mining and drug smuggling. Massoud's militia ran heroin through Central Asia to Russia. They sold lapis and emeralds at gem shows as far away as Las Vegas. From his base in Talokan, a ragged town to the west of the Panjshir Valley, Massoud appointed new commanders and intelligence chiefs to begin rebuilding his forces and his information networks across Afghanistan. He told his men that the Taliban would grow vulnerable with time. When Pashtuns discovered that the Taliban were bent on an Islamist totalitarian state, Massoud predicted, dissent would rise. "Day by day," recalled Mohammed Neem, Massoud's intelligence chief during this period, "his loyal Panjshiri soldiers gradually saw we could stand against the Taliban." Massoud and his men were very suspicious of the United States. It was difficult to believe that the Pakistani support for the Taliban they had witnessed as Kabul fell could have occurred without at least tacit American backing. Massoud had captured Pakistani citizens in the fighting around Kabul. Then there was the confusing, conspiracy-shrouded question of the Unocal pipeline project. Where did the Americans stand? Massoud's inner circle discussed the question at length, but they lacked confidence about the answer. Had they known the truth, they might not have believed it. Even at this late stage, the American government and its intelligence services lacked a complete understanding of covert Pakistani support for the Taliban, an ignorance born mainly from lack of interest and effort. A December 1996 State Department cable reported that Pakistani intelligence was secretly supplying cash, equipment, and military advisors to the Taliban, and that high-level Pakistani officers from ISI were fighting inside Afghanistan along with uneducated recruits from Pakistan. We recently have received more credible information about the extent and origin of Pakistani assistance and support to the Taliban, the Islamabad embassy reported. But the question was uncertain enough within confidential American government channels that Ambassador Tom Simons could report to Washington just a few weeks later that Pakistani aid to the Taliban was probably less malign than most imagine, and probably amounted to much less than rumored. "Military advice to the Taliban may be there, but is probably not all that significant," Simons concluded. Long practiced at covert programs in Afghanistan, the Pakistanis had deceived Washington about the Taliban for 2 solid years. Massoud sought to attract American attention. In a general atmosphere of estrangement, especially from the State Department, there was one opening he could exploit, the offer made by Gary Schroen and the CIA to reopen a direct channel of cooperation. Massoud's first reaction to the Stinger recovery proposal, recalled his Washington representative, Daoud Mir, was, "No way. I want to discuss with them the policy of Afghanistan, the future of Afghanistan." But with the loss of Kabul, he had a new motivation. If he energetically brokered missile sales, he could have an understanding and good relations between the United States and the United Front, as his aide Mohideen Mehdi put it. Massoud told his men to start making inquiries about Stingers with commanders across the North. He wanted something to show the Americans. Many of the warlords they approached had previously pledged allegiance to Hekmatyar. When Kabul fell, the Taliban had expelled Hekmatyar from Afghanistan to exile in Iran. Many in Hekmatyar's old network switched allegiance to the Taliban, but some commanders in the north who were cut off needed money. Massoud's network even managed to buy a few Stingers from behind Taliban lines. For Massoud, the reward was to draw attention from the CIA, as one of his intelligence aides put it. "We wanted to use it as a means of getting our message, the message of resistance and the message of the cause, back to Washington." Gary Schroen flew to Talokan in the early spring of 1997 to renew talks with Massoud. He and Alan Eastham, then deputy chief of mission at the embassy in Islamabad, caught a scheduled United Nations charter. The Taliban were pushing north. As Schroen and Easton prepared to meet with Massoud, a Taliban plane flew over and dropped a bomb. Gunfire echoed on Talokan's outskirts. Schroen and his colleagues in the CIA's Near East Division were skeptical about whether Massoud could be a worthwhile ally against bin Laden. Massoud was candid about the problems. He had to worry about the Taliban, and the Arab training camps that concerned the CIA were a long distance off. He said he was happy to cooperate as best he could, but he didn't want the CIA to have inflated expectations. For his part, Schroen argued that Massoud could assist not only the United States but his own military cause if he helped eliminate bin Laden from the Afghan battlefield. The agency's counter-terrorist center hoped to provide initial supplies of secure communications gear that would permit Massoud's intelligence aides to send messages and talk to Langley. The center's bin Laden unit informed a congressional committee in closed session on April 10, 1997, that it was now running operations designed to collect target intelligence in Afghanistan for use in the future, should the United States decide to capture bin Laden or attack his organization. The communications gear would also permit Massoud's agents behind Taliban lines to report back about bin Laden's safe houses and movements, but there was no cash or firm planning yet available. Schroen told Massoud that for follow-up contacts, it would probably best to use CIA stations in Central Asia. With Massoud now pushed so far north, it would be easier for officers to meet with him from Tashkent or Dushanbe than from Islamabad. Massoud's side, too, preferred to interact with the CIA in Central Asia. It had long bothered them that their contacts with the agency were centered on the Islamabad station, which maintained such close ties with Massoud's enemies at ISI. In Talokan that March, they talked about using CIA storage and transit facilities in Central Asia to move recovered Stingers out of the north. Massoud and his advisors remained frustrated by the Americans. The United States was missing the real danger, they felt. The Taliban, Pakistani intelligence, and their Arab volunteers. Massoud and his men interpreted the CIA's agenda as Stingers, first and foremost. They respected Schroen and saw him as a tough, devoted operative, but their talks with him were fitful and sporadic. The political and military discussions, including those about bin Laden and terrorism, were as yet no deeper than those Massoud and his aides had routinely at foreign embassies. They felt they needed much more. On his own, Massoud rebuilt his intelligence networks and sabotage operations. There were many sympathetic Tajiks behind Taliban lines, especially around Kabul. Traders moved freely between the two zones. Massoud's special forces, some living as undercover cells in the capital, blew up Taliban equipment at the Kabul airport. His intelligence group established a special unit that year focused on Arab and Pakistani forces that fought alongside the Taliban. Through their sources, they picked up word about assassination plots against Massoud. They received one report that an assassin had been dispatched to kill Massoud by placing in his shoes a mysterious powder, possibly anthrax. Recalled Neem, the intelligence chief during 1997, "We appointed one person for 1 year to guard Ahmed Shah Massoud's shoes." The Taliban swept into Mazar-e-Sharif that May. The bearded, turbaned Pashtun and Pakistani madrasa graduates who poured into the city center in pickup trucks were as foreign an invasion force as the blue-eyed Russian conscripts who'd rumbled through on Soviet tanks 18 years before. The largest and most important city in northern Afghanistan, Mazar was a secular, urbane, relatively prosperous city with 16 channels of satellite television and billboards festooned with the clean-shaven, mustached face of its longtime overlord, Abu Rashid Dostum, a former communist general who wore his religion lightly. Mazar's dominant turquoise-domed mosque legendarily entombs a son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad, a central figure in the Shia faith, anathema to the Taliban. The Taliban's shock troops were a long way from Kandahar now. They did not speak the local language, but Mullah Omar continued to believe his movement was destined to conquer all of Afghanistan by military force. His new consultant, Osama bin Laden, increasingly urged the revival of ancient Central Asian Islamic empires that would reach all the way to contemporary Russia, and Pakistani intelligence concluded that the Taliban had to seize Mazar if they were to make a plausible claim for international recognition as Afghanistan's government. ISI calculated in the spring of 1997 that a recognized Taliban government